We're continuing now with tonight's installment of Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection, part 3. During the last segment of tonight's program, we took a look at the illegal immigrant status of not only Mohammed Salameh, named as a suspect in the World Trade Center bombing, but also Mir Aimal Khansi, a Pakistani national who has been tabbed as the chief suspect in the shooting and fatal wounding of two people, two CIA employees outside CIA headquarters earlier this year. This particular incident is also, it's basically spurring a serious investigative effort, and it remains to be seen whether this incident serves as a pretext for increased police powers and surveillance powers at home. I suspect that this, as well as the World Trade Center bombing and other things, will be used by the intelligence community to justify a continuation of the Cold War agenda. Obviously, there's no more Soviet Union and no more Cold War, but I suspect that in lieu of the evil empire, incidents like this and the World Trade Center bombing will be used to justify a continuation of the massive U.S. intelligence operations that have characterized the Cold War period, and I suspect it will also, these incidents will also be used to justify a broadening, or at least a continuation, of the license that has been allowed U.S. intelligence here at home as well. What remains to be seen is whether or not these incidents are being generated by the national security establishment or the intelligence community in order to basically to justify their situations. In other words, basically what remains to be determined is whether or not they are provocations. I suspect that may very well be the case. In the Chronicle of Wednesday, the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, February 10th of 1993, there's an AP story which basically talks about the search for the suspect in the CIA shootings. Worldwide manhunt begins for suspect named in CIA shootings. Stateline, Fairfax, Virginia, and it's an Associated Press story. Skipping down in the story, we quote, "We have no reason to believe he's left the country, but we have no reason to believe he hasn't," unquote. Police Captain David Franklin said at a news conference. Nonetheless, FBI Special Agent Robert Ryan said, quote, "A worldwide manhunt is being launched at this time," unquote. He said Khansi also is being placed on the FBI's list of 10 most wanted fugitives. Well, again, as indicated in the article that I read in the last segment of tonight's program, the suspect entered the United States illegally, and that, as well as Mohammed Salameh's illegal immigrant status, is spurring calls for a tightening of U.S. immigration laws, reminiscent in certain respects of the calls for tightening of immigration in Germany, immigration laws in Germany as well. It remains to be seen just exactly what comes of the search for the culprit in the CIA shooting, whether he's still in the U.S. or whether he's elsewhere, but that's among the incidents that I think we need to take a look at. And I suspect that it may be one element of a concert, in a concert of events, which may be being coordinated by the terrorist connected, the explicitly fascist elements of our national security establishment. Once again, I want to reiterate that that is not a statement I'm making, it's a question I'm asking, but I suspect that may very well be the case. An interesting detail concerning the shooting outside of CIA headquarters was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, February 12th of 1993. This also is an AP story, datelined Quetta, Pakistan, and headlined CIA Shooting Suspect Eludes Authorities. Its subheaded, "Family Says He Returned to Pakistani Hometown But Left Sunday." Skipping down in the story, there's an interesting detail. Well, there are several interesting details. But this particular detail concerns the fact that Mr. Khansi, at one point, was employed by a company owned by Chris Marchetti, the son of Victor Marchetti, a former CIA, quote, ex-unquote, CIA operative, who was fiercely critical of the CIA. In fact, wrote a book critical of the CIA called The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. Skipping down in the story, Khansi became restless after his father died in 1989 and moved to the United States 2 years later, family sources said. He occasionally called home, but never revealed where he was living, they said. According to the Immigration and Naturalization Service in Washington, Khansi applied for political asylum in February of 1992, but his application has not been approved and he was not a legal resident. Khansi worked for about 6 months for a courier service owned by Chris Marchetti, whose father, Victor, was once a top aide to former CIA Director Richard Helms. Victor Marchetti, who shares office space with his son, said Khansi last showed up at work on January 24th. It's also worth noting that the hometown where Kanzi grew up was among the many towns in Pakistan that had a large CIA presence due to the massive CIA support for the Mujahideen, the Afghan Mujahideen, who were based in Pakistan and fighting against the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. It remains to be determined just what exactly, if any, is the significance of Kanzi having worked for Chris Marchetti, the father of Victor Marchetti. There may be no significance whatsoever. However, it may be intent. One of the things that I also will be looking for, we may not see anything explicitly stated, but it may serve to cast aspersions on the critics of the CIA. When CIA station chief in Greece, Richard Welch, was assassinated in 1975, his assassination was tabbed by the CIA as the result of anti-CIA activity, not only by former CIA operative Philip Agee, but also the Church Committee as well. Their activities were deemed to have compromised the CIA's security and blown Welch's cover and resulted in his assassination. It was determined that the activities of Agee and the Church Committee had nothing whatsoever to do with the assassination of Richard Welch, whose CIA status was apparently quite well known in Greece. Nonetheless, that incident did serve as a propaganda tool, as a propaganda asset for the CIA in attempting to rebut its critics. With Victor Marchetti being among the more prominent of the CIA's critics over the last 20 years, I wonder whether perhaps we will see a similar campaign, and it will be hinted perhaps that Chris Marchetti and Victor Marchetti were no goodniks, and that are the kind of people who would harbor the sort of character who pulled this off. There may be nothing whatsoever to that. Certainly one cannot blame Victor Marchetti for the activities of an employee of his son's firm, but guilt by association is something that that the far right in this country has long utilized, and it's among the things that I hold open as we examine the CIA shooting. Again, there may be nothing to it, but it'll be interesting to see if we see a campaign similar to the one that followed the assassination of Mr. Welch in 1975. I think that this incident, as well as the World Trade Center bombing and other things, may very well be used as a pretext for tightening immigration laws. Certainly the call is already out to do just exactly that. We may find incidents like this being used to, as I said, justify a perpetuation of the intelligence community's massive Cold War stance and a continuation of the CIA. There have been calls to abolish the CIA after the end of the Cold War. And again, it'll be interesting to see if we have more incidents like the shooting outside CIA headquarters, like the World Trade Center bombing, because I suspect that what we may be looking at is an active program of destabilization of the Clinton administration, not unlike what happened to Jimmy Carter. Certainly having things like this come down on Clinton's watch tends to make Clinton look weak. Basically, it creates the impression that, well, somebody's got to do something. Listen to the way people talk. Your average American, listen to the way that people you know at work or friends of yours talk about the way these incidents, talk about these incidents, I should say. We're going to hear calls, I suspect, for a tightening, a crackdown. Clinton will be portrayed as weak, unable to adequately govern the country in such a way as to prevent this sort of thing happening. Jimmy Carter was portrayed as a wimp in a similar context, and it'll be interesting to see if we see Bill Clinton being portrayed as a weakling because of his inability to stop all these illegal immigrants and these terrorists and these no-goodniks perpetrating things like the shooting outside CIA headquarters and the World Trade Center bombing. And again, right the week after Clinton was elected, I warned that the national security establishment, which blew John Kennedy's brains out, which destabilized Jimmy Carter's administration, and which has successfully overthrown innumerable foreign governments, as well as maintained a similar situation here at home. Basically, anyone who has challenged the status quo in the United States has either been effectively discredited or neutralized, like Jimmy Carter, or violently eliminated, like John and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a great many other people. I noted the shooting outside CIA headquarters, and although it is not being directly linked with the following article, I suspect that that may also, that incident, which is now, as we saw, sparking a worldwide manhunt, I suspect that incident may also lend weight to the following. I've seen a lot of outrageous articles, a lot of outrageous things over the 20 years that I've been doing political research and the 14 years that I've been on the air. None more outrageous than the following. In the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, February 10th of 1993, there was a Washington Post story, Dateline Washington, and headline, Wider Law Enforcement Role for CIA. It's subheaded, Agency's Shortcomings in Iraq Loan Scandal Prompted Changes. It reads in part, The CIA's mishandling of information about a bank scandal involving loans to Iraq has led to internal changes that will give the agency an enhanced and possibly controversial role in future U.S. law enforcement activities, according to CIA officials and independent experts. The changes are aimed at breaching, without destroying, the political and bureaucratic barriers that have prevented the intelligence agency from assisting domestic law enforcement investigations. The barriers were erected to prevent the CIA from becoming involved in spying on U.S. citizens at home, which it is generally barred by law from doing. I would interject, it may be barred by law from doing it, but that certainly has not stopped it in any way. Again, it was the evidence strongly suggests that the intelligence community was deeply involved in the support for Saddam Hussein. One of the things that we looked at in the past, and an article written by Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel, was a discussion of the arming of Iraq, the arming of the Afghan Mujahideen, and the arming of Iran as part of the same operation. The three phases of the operation were called Magdalene, Magellan, and Michelangelo. Michelangelo referring to the arming of Iran. I do not know which of the other two referred to the Afghan Mujahideen and Iraq. We have seen in the past in various archive shows that many of the same U.S. intelligence fronts that were used in the Iranian weapons transfers as part of the Iran-Contra scandal were also used to help arm Iraq as well, the STEBOM and Valsella Mecanotecnica operations in Italy being two of them. Also, it should be noted that, it's really not a secret that the intelligence community was involved in the arming of Iraq, and I strongly suspect that the BNL scandal was not bungled by the CIA, but rather was deliberately obscured by the CIA. The evidence points very strongly in that direction. And to see now that the CIA's, quote, bungling, unquote, or its, quote, shortcomings, unquote, vis-a-vis the BNL scandal, this is now being used as a rationalization for increasing the CIA's role in domestic law enforcement. This is an outrage. The CIA is already deeply involved in the surveillance of American citizens. The nominal prohibition against that is just that. It's simply an empty provision. I would note, too, that by increasing the CIA's role in law enforcement, that is not only providing the CIA with a post-Cold War rationalization for its existence, but beyond that, it represents a step in the direction of martial law and totalitarianism. Against the background, the things that I'm discussing not only this evening, but in the other installments of Radio Free America 38, should be seen against the background of America's long-term economic and financial situation. As I've described so often, in the 1980s, the U.S. became a debtor nation, now the world's biggest debtor nation. From 1917 through 1980, the U.S. was the world's biggest creditor nation. We were owed more money than any nation on Earth. We now are the world's biggest debtor nation. We owe more money than all of the third world countries combined. The savings and loan scandal is going to cost U.S. taxpayers anywhere from $500 billion to $1.4 trillion, depending on which estimate you believe. The lower estimate, $500 billion, is approximately the cost of the Second World War, updated to contemporary dollars. The commercial banks are in very bad shape. They've enjoyed enormous profits in the last 6 months, or actually in the last couple of years, last quarter in particular. That is due to the difference between long-term and short-term interest rates, which for the time being anyway, that difference is considerable. I would note that that is not going to remain that way forever, and the commercial banks are in a situation not unlike the situation of the savings and loan industry in the late 1970s. So the long-term prospects for the commercial banks, I think, are to be viewed as very, very serious. The prognostication by various banking experts that the loosening of bank regulations that took effect in December of this past year would perhaps lead to increased bank failures. That has not, thank God, come true. But the long-term prospects for the U.S. financial system are very grave indeed. There's also enormous corporate debt from the leverage buyouts of the 1980s and the go-go financing of the 1980s. There's enormous consumer debt. The insurance companies are also in very bad shape. And I would note that the insurance companies insure most of the money market funds. They are privately insured. So if the insurance companies go down, a lot of other things are going to follow. The long-term economic prospects for this country are very, very bad. The U.S. industrial base is being eroded as U.S.-based corporations move manufacturing facilities abroad. And I do not know exactly when it is going to happen. And I tend to suspect that there will not be a dramatic economic collapse along the lines of the stock market crash in 1929. But in the long run, over the long haul, the prospects for the U.S. economy are very, very grave indeed. Indeed, an economic disaster is almost an inevitability, although I would be the last person in the world to say when it will happen. It might happen in the next 6 months. It might happen over the next several years. It might happen over the next 50 to 75 years. But the U.S. has in many ways gone down the same historical path that Argentina went down. At the turn of the century, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the country of Argentina was among the wealthiest on earth. The phrase riches in Argentine became something of a cliche, but Argentina basically pursued extremely irresponsible fiscal policies, not unlike what the U.S. has done, and the situation in Argentina became so grave that by the early 1980s, the inflation rate was so high that workers were being paid twice a day because in a half a working day, the buying power of their wages was significantly reduced due to the enormous rate of inflation. I don't know whether the situation will get that bad in the United States, but the handwriting is on the wall economically for the United States, and it spells doom. I don't want to seem like a prophet of doom, but frankly, you do not do what the United States has done in the 1980s and 90s and get away with it. The future of the American economy and the future for the individual American citizen could basically be summed up with the phrase debt service. That is the future for America. And as the U.S. economy declines, and it is going to decline, the number of people who could be counted among the have-nots as opposed to the haves is going to increase. And provisions are going to be made to deal with these people, whether they are going to be put into labor camps or whether they will simply be wiped out as long as they're out of sight and out of mind. I do not know, but I will guarantee you that the economic decline of this country, whether it is precipitous or, as I suspect, whether it is gradual, the economic decline of this country is going to produce severe social dislocation. That severe social dislocation is going to produce political unrest, and the provisions are now being made, in my opinion, and I should add that this is by no means my opinion alone, to deal with that political unrest. And it is against the background of America's long-term and inevitable economic decline that the events that I'm discussing in Radio Free America 38 should be seen. As I cite the National Security Establishment's counter-terrorist infrastructures and their past history of being used to bypass the machinery of democracy in the Iran-Contra scandal, and as I cite the continued existence of these infrastructures, note again that among the infrastructures that grew out of the recommendations coming out of the Vice President's Task Force on Terrorism, note that the martial law contingency plans with the plans to round up and deport terrorist aliens are among those provisions. And at some point in the future, I don't know whether we're talking about 6 months from now, 5 years from now, or 50 or 75 years from now, at some point in the future, those infrastructures, if they are allowed to continue to exist, will be used to eliminate all vestiges of American democracy in this country, perhaps in response to a series of incidents, perhaps in response to one large, quote, unforeseen, unquote, incident. But it is against the inevitable economic decline of this country, whether it is gradual or precipitous, that the events that I'm describing this evening and the processes that I have been outlining and detailing in Radio Free America 38 should be seen. Bear in mind, too, that if this seems really off the wall to the new, to the uninitiated listener, bear in mind that as we looked at in Radio Free America number 10, which I rebroadcast some weeks back, there was an attempted fascist coup in 1934. industrialists and financiers, primarily those grouped around the House of Morgan, attempted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. And ultimately, the coup attempt in 34 and other coup attempts backed by fascist elements in 1939, those coup attempts were unsuccessful. The coup attempt of November 22, 1963, was very successful, and further coups, somewhat along the lines of what we have seen in Latin America, at least in certain respects, where one military junta is eventually replaced by an even more virulent junta, by an even more severe junta. That has been a pattern in many Latin American countries, and ultimately I think that is the pattern that we will be seeing in the United States. And the martial law contingency plans that came to light in the Iran-Contra scandal, growing out of the U.S. national security establishment's counter-terrorist infrastructures, those are an absolutely critical thing to be recognized and dealt with. And if they are not recognized and dealt with at some point, they are going to be activated, whether in response to an economic crisis or an environmental crisis or a political crisis, I cannot say. We're going to be discussing that, by the way, next week. For those people who think that this is absolute stuff and nonsense, it should be borne in mind that the military itself is actively debating the efficacy of these things right now, and we're going to be looking at that next week. I refer listeners to an article in the January 1993 issue of The Atlantic called Colonel Dunlap's Coup, which we're going to be dealing with next week. Hopefully we'll get to it next week, if not in weeks following. But as we examine the long-term prospects for the United States, the wider domestic law enforcement role for the CIA is something which I find very ominous, and the fact that this is being rationalized as necessary because of the agency's shortcomings in the Iraqgate scandal, the BNL scandal, that is absolutely outrageous. But note, again, that we are now seeing a provision being made, or at least advocated, for a wider domestic law enforcement role for the CIA. That is a significant step toward martial law. In three different times in 1993, I've interviewed Farah Mansour, an Iranian and a member of the Iranian resistance, who has done some truly historic research, some landmark work, indicating that the Iran-Contra scandal proper and of the October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the United States Embassy in Tehran in November of 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured, those events themselves grew out of a much deeper and longer-standing pattern of cooperation between the U.S. intelligence community or dominant elements thereof, primarily those elements grouped around George Bush, the Wilson-Turpel milieu. The U.S. intelligence community had learned, according to Farah Mansour's historic research, of the Shah's cancer in the early 1970s, specifically in 74, and they began making provisions then for an anti-communist successor to Khomeini, and they tabbed the Islamic fundamentalists as a suitably anti-communist successor to the Shah of Iran. It should also be noted that the intelligence community has actively collaborated with Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan as well. And I would note, too, that part of the legacy of the Reinhard Gehlen organization is a pattern of cooperation between fascist elements, some of which are allied with our intelligence system, and Islamic extremists. This pattern goes all the way back to the Second World War, when Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the first political leader of the Palestinian National Movement, Haji Amin al-Husseini was actually a major in the SS and worked very closely with the Third Reich during World War II, and became an intimate element of the post-World War II Third Reich, the post-World War II Third Reich residua, both those that were underground and those that were overground and working with the U.S. intelligence system. Again, Radio Free America number 22 and the miscellaneous two-part archive series dealing with the fascist third position go into that. And it is against the background of the collaboration between the U.S. national security establishment and the Islamic fundamentalist movements in various countries that I view some of the events that we're seeing. Bear in mind now that rightly or wrongly, Islamic fundamentalists are being implicated in the World Trade Center bombing. I would note, too, that the U.S. Financial Nerve Center, which the World Trade Center is to a certain extent, is not the only financial nerve center which has been bombed recently. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, March 13th of 1993. Yesterday, this is a Chronicle Wire Services story, Dateline Bombay, headlined, 13 Bombs Rip Bombay. Reading the first couple of paragraphs. A synchronized series of powerful bomb blasts rocked India's commercial nerve center yesterday, spreading panic in a city still recovering from Hindu-Muslim riots. Nearly 200 people were killed and 1,100 wounded. Thunderous explosions shook skyscrapers, set fire to the nation's largest stock exchange. Again, bear in mind that's similar in some ways. Now, that Wall Street wasn't bombed, but the commodities trading center in New York City is located in the World Trade Center, and numerous brokerage institutions also had offices there. Reiterating what I've read so far in this article, a synchronized series of powerful bomb blasts rocked India's commercial nerve center yesterday, spreading panic in a city still recovering from Hindu-Muslim riots. Nearly 200 people were killed and 1,100 wounded. Thunderous explosions shook skyscrapers, set fire to the nation's largest stock exchange, gutted the ground floor of the headquarters of India's international airline, blew apart a passenger bus, and damaged three hotels. An official spokesman put the death toll at 197. No group stepped forward to claim responsibility for the 13 blasts, which detonated from the southern financial district to the northern suburbs in a 75-minute period, and authorities gave no indication that they knew who carried them out. But the explosions were certain to deepen suspicions between the city's Hindu and Muslim communities, which are already living in fear because of recent sectarian riots. Violence raged over a 9-day period in January as mobs of Hindu extremists went on a rampage, singling out Muslims and their homes and businesses for attack. Again, it remains to be seen who is tabbed as the culprit in this apparently very sophisticated campaign of bombing. But once again, I suspect we will see Islamic fundamentalists or Muslim extremists, whatever term you want to use, tabbed as the culprits here. And look for Islamic fundamentalism to perhaps, at least to a certain extent, replace the evil empire, the now extinct evil empire, as the justification for continued large military budgets in the United States and the continuation of a vast military structure along the lines of the one that we have coming out of the Cold War, much as the incidents like the World Trade Center bombing and the shooting outside of CIA headquarters, whatever the true nature of those incidents, and I suspect they both may be provocations, but whatever their true nature, those incidents are sure to provide justification for the continuation of a massive intelligence apparatus in this country along the lines of what grew out of the Cold War. And I suspect that the new enemy, there's been a lot of discussion about what the new enemy will be, what will the U.S. military do in the post-Cold War period. And a lot of people have wondered what the Pentagon will do to try and justify continued enormous budgets. One of the possibilities that I think has to be very seriously considered is that the new evil empire will be Islamic extremism, whether in the United States or elsewhere. And indeed, we're seeing a lot of it these days. Reading from the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 11th of 1993. This is an L.A. Times story by Kim Murphy, datelined Cairo, and headlined, Day of Killing in Egypt as Cops Raid Extremists. Subheaded, Toll is 26 dead, 40 hurt. Worst violence since 1981. And again, the first two paragraphs of this. Egyptian authorities, faced with a growing wave of Islamic fundamentalist violence, conducted raids yesterday against suspected extremists that left 26 people dead and at least 40 wounded. The death toll, which resulted from a series of shootouts at extremist hideouts in and around Cairo and at a fundamentalist mosque in the southern city of Aswan, was the biggest in a single day since the abortive Islamic uprising that followed the assassination of President Anwar Sadat in 1981. So once again, we see the Sadat assassination coming back into play, or at least coming back into mention here. Again, bear in mind that Islamic fundamentalists did that, and we're now seeing allegations of connections between the milieu involved in the Sadat assassination and the people involved in the World Trade Center bombing. Indeed, skipping down in this particular story, the violent clashes came less than 2 weeks after a bomb destroyed a crowded coffee shop in downtown Cairo, killing three people. The homemade explosive, packed with nails, blew up on the same day that an apparent follower of Egyptian fundamentalist cleric Omar Abdul Rahman was accused of helping to detonate a truckload of explosives at New York's World Trade Center. And I find it interesting that this bomb being attributed to a follower, this basically being the perpetrator of this explosion, is maintained here to be a follower of the same Omar Abdul Rahman that was attending the mosque that Mohammed Salome was attending. It's interesting that bomb would go off on the very same day that the World Trade Center gets lit up, allegedly, by Mohammed Salome. And again, I suspect that whether or not Salome and this Nidal Ayad were actually involved, and whether, in fact, Omar Abdul Rahman was implicated in the background of some of these things, I suspect that these incidents may very, that is to say, the World Trade Center may very well be a provocation. And given the track record of significant elements of U.S. intelligence having been involved with international terrorism, given the track record of the U.S. national security establishment and intelligence community's involvement with Islamic fundamentalism in the past, the wave of bombings that struck the commercial nerve center in India, in Bombay, much as a commercial nerve center in New York, the World Trade Center, was bombed, I suspect that these incidents, the bombing in Cairo, which took place on the same day as the World Trade Center went up, the World Trade Center bombing, the bombs in India, in Bombay, which I suspect are going to be laid at the doorstep of Islamic fundamentalists or Muslim extremists, I suspect these incidents may very well be connected, and that they may very well be connected to our national security establishment. Note also, again, that Mohammed Salome and Mr. Khansi, the suspect that has been named in the CIA headquarters shootings, they were both illegal immigrants. Mr. Khansi is from Pakistan, a site of active U.S. support, the site of active support of the U.S. intelligence community for Islamic fundamentalist forces during the course of the Afghan war. So, again, these various incidents seemingly disconnected, they may be isolated incidents, but I suspect that they are connected, and I suspect that we are looking at basically the counter-terrorist infrastructure of our intelligence system at work. That is obviously not a statement we can make at this point. There's nowhere near enough information to make such a statement definitively, but I suspect that may be the case, and it falls in the category of what I so often tab as food for thought and grounds for further research. Reviewing an article that we looked at some weeks back, another car bomb, another assassination of a counter-terrorist journalist, this also being laid at the doorstep of Islamic fundamentalists. This is a story from the Los Angeles Times of January 25th of 1993. This is an article by Hugh Pope of the LA Times, Dateline Istanbul, Turkey, headlined, Car Bomb Kills Turkish Foe of Extremists. I'm not going to read the article. This was read into Radio Free America 38 in an earlier installment. But the victim in this car bombing blamed on Islamic extremists was Ugur Mumcu, an individual whose work documenting connections between the CIA and the Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the fascist National Action Party in Turkey, we cited in Radio Free America number 21, the fifth program in a five-part Radio Free America series dealing with the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. So Ugur Mumcu is no longer on the scene. Whatever further work he might have done to reveal the connections between elements of U.S. intelligence and the National Action Party and the Grey Wolves, well, that work will not be conducted. He also was assassinated by, quote, Islamic fundamentalists, unquote. Again, bear in mind that when the U.S. national security establishment decides to move in any given direction, they do so when to move in that direction will scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. And as we look at the bombs going off abroad, supposedly being set off by Islamic fundamentalists, when we see the incidents at home, the shooting outside CIA headquarters, the World Trade Center bombing, bear in mind one of the things that I've cited so often, vis-a-vis the support of elements of our intelligence system for international terrorism, it serves as a pretext for a crackdown at home, broader police powers, increased surveillance, fewer civil liberties, basically creeping martial law, if you will. It also serves as a pretext for military adventurism abroad, to drop bombs on this, that, or the other country, or invade, or stage a commando raid on this, that, or the other country, or perhaps even an open invasion. It remains to be seen. There was a column in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, March 10th of 1993, by a fellow named Mark Juergensmeyer, who is described here as, by the way, his name is spelled Juergensmeyer. He's described as the dean of the University of Hawaii School of Hawaiian, Asian, and Pacific Studies. And there's an article here entitled, a column, I should say, an op-ed column entitled, Why Islamic Radicals Hate America. And he begins here, the first two paragraphs, Why was the World Trade Center the target of an alleged Muslim attack? A recent statement by Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the radical Egyptian cleric who reportedly inspired Mohammed A. Salome and other members of a New Jersey Islamic cell, provides a significant clue. Abdul Rahman condemned Egypt's government as a, quote, vestige of colonialism, unquote. He implied that the Western-style political organization of Egypt was alien to the traditional religious and social values of the country. Like many religious activists, he has imagined a worldwide conspiracy, led by America, to destroy traditional cultures and create mini-Americas throughout the globe. And in describing some of the inspirations for Sheikh Rahman's viewpoint, the author here cites, among others, an individual that, an additional fellow named Faraj, who was the immediate inspiration for Abdul Rahman's philosophy. He cites the work of a fellow named Saeed Qutb, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation on that. This individual's name is capital S, A-Y-Y-I-D, last name capital Q-U-T-B. I'll call it Qutb. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but that's how I'm going to pronounce it here. Continuing with tonight's broadcast, skipping down in this column, it's interesting to find the inspiration for Sheikh Rahman and his immediate inspiration, Faraj, being laid, at least by this writer, to Saeed Qutb. He was an individual who began his activities and his support for terrorism in Egypt in the 1950s. And Egypt in the 1950s is a place where we have visited research-wise before. Indeed, it was Egypt in the 1950s where the first Palestinian terrorist groups were put together, not by Islamic fundamentalist extremists, but rather by the contingent of Gehlen operatives and Nazi war criminals headed up by Otto Skorzeny that were dispatched by the CIA to set up the Egyptian General Staff and Intelligence Service for Nasser in order to help woo Nasser away from the Soviet Union shortly after he succeeded to power in Egypt. By the way, we looked at that in Radio Free America program number 3. We would look at it in Radio Free America program number 4 and Radio Free America program number 22. No, actually, we 3, 4, and 22 contained that information. Skipping down in this column, also we looked at that, by the way, in the miscellaneous archive show about the fascist third position. If people would like to find a printed source for that, there are a number of them. The book Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, the book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, also a cover story on the May 1987 issue of Mother Jones magazine authored by Kevin Coogan and Marty Lee. Skipping down in this particular column of the work of Saeed Qutb in Egypt in the 1950s, Faraj and Abdul Rahman were influenced by the thought of Saeed Qutb, an earlier Muslim writer in Egypt who also identified Western culture as the great enemy of Islam. Qutb wrote a series of pamphlets in Cairo in the 1950s and, like Faraj, was implicated in political assassinations and executed. Although he was not as explicit as Faraj in indicating acceptable techniques of terror, Qutb laid the groundwork for Faraj's understanding of jihad as an appropriate response to the advocates of Western culture and modern society. Specifically, Qutb railed against those who encouraged the cultural, political, and economic domination of the Egyptian government by the West. Qutb himself had spent several years in the United States studying educational administration, but this experience only confirmed his impression that American society was essentially racist, and that American policy in the Middle East was dictated by Israel and what he regarded as the Jewish lobby in Washington. Alarmed at the degree to which the new government in Egypt was modeled after Western political institutions and influenced by Western values, Qutb wrote a widely circulated pamphlet, quote, This Religion of Islam, unquote, which advocated a radical return to Islamic values and Muslim law. What it'll be interesting to learn is whether or not there was any connection between some of the forces grouped around the Skorzeny contingent in Egypt in the 1950s, which was in touch, as we've looked at in our program about the fascist third position, which was in touch with the people who were grouped around Haj Amin al-Husseini, who had worked for the SS during World War II. I wonder, and this is pure speculation and should be understood as just that, I wonder whether perhaps Saeed Qutb at some point had come in contact with the Skorzeny Galen CIA contingent, which basically provided the springboard for the generation of, quote, Palestinian terrorism, unquote. If you can find it, by the way, there's an interesting book called From Cairo to Damascus, which is authored by John Roy Carlson, the pen name for an anti-fascist writer and researcher named Arthur Derunian, whose best-known work was Undercover, a book you still can find, even though it was published in 1943. And in his tour of the Middle East in the early 1950s, John Roy Carlson, a.k.a. Arthur Derunian, found a remarkable acceptance of such documents as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, one of the ideological pillars of Hitler's philosophy. He found a remarkable, not only acceptance of it, but the widespread dissemination of the protocols in the Middle East in the early 1950s. Obviously, the Arab nations were deeply polarized by their opposition to Israel. I wonder to what extent elements of the Islamic fundamentalist movement may have actually been in touch with some of the Skorzeny, Third Reich, Galen-connected elements that we have studied in the past. Certainly, the Third Reich and the Galen organization after it did have links into the Islamic movement through Haj Amin al-Husseini and company, and I wonder to what extent they not only maintained but broadened those links, and to what extent those elements of U.S. intelligence that have actively collaborated with Islamic fundamentalism may have basically picked up where they left off. An op-ed column appeared in the New York Times of Thursday, March 4th of 1993. This was authored by writer Robert Stone. It's called The New Barbarians, and it's Dateline Baltimore. It reads in part as follows. Put yourself in the mind's eye of the bomber, whoever he is. It's likely to be... Put yourself in the mind's eye of the bomber. Whoever he is, it's likely he first viewed the city from the air, looked out and saw the twin towers mirroring each other's dizzying rise. Or maybe he stood at the window of a safe house in Queens or New Jersey and looked at them thrusting so immodestly over 1,000 feet in the air. No doubt he thought they mocked his passionate intensity. Skipping down. In striking at symbols, terrorists destroy the real lives of American... In striking at symbols, terrorists destroy the real lives of American working people, traumatize actual American children. We will learn to cope as other nations have. We are good at coping. Eventually, few Americans will remember the country as it was before X-ray machines appeared at airports and in the vestibules of public buildings, before security guards were deployed at every other corporate door. During the Cold War, we lived in fear of nuclear holocaust. Now we know that if a nuclear device ever goes off in an American city, it will not likely come launched from some Siberian silo. More probably, it will have been assembled by a few people, perhaps in the guise of immigrants, in that safe house with a view of lower Manhattan. And we've discussed provocation and terrorism at great length over the years. The prospect of a nuclear terrorist incident, whether it actually is pulled off or whether it merely is threatened, a nuclear provocation, if you will, is truly a daunting prospect. If the powers that be in this country ever deemed it necessary to establish martial law in one fell swoop, and I suspect that the process that we're looking at will take place over a period of years, possibly even decades. It will take place, I'm convinced, but it may take, I suspect it will be a gradual process. But the pace of institution of martial law, the pace of institution of dictatorship and fascism in this country will be determined by the pace and the rate of economic decline. Whether it's slow or whether it's fast will determine whether the elimination of our democratic institutions, the institution of the martial law contingency plans already on the books, the pace of their institution will be determined by the rate and pace of economic decline. If that economic decline should ever be become precipitous, or if the prospects are viewed as being precipitous by the powers that be in this country, If they ever want to institute martial law in one fell swoop, a nuclear incident would be the perfect opportunity to do that.